If there, we can first start by taking some questions for the audience, for any of the speakers, if anybody has anything. Yeah.
Okay, there's a microphone coming to you over in a second, because I'm too infirm to get that far that fast.
So my question is directed towards Laura, but could be directed to the rest of the panel as well. But so recently, the last 2 or 3 years, there's been some exciting translational research going on with the artificial implantable trachea, pioneered by Mike Irini's group at the Karolinska Institute. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on their approach as far as using a synthetic material coated with autologous stem cells. And do you see a decellularization strategy that you pose as being an advantageous therapy as far as being translated into the clinic for an implantable trachea?
Well, there's, so, you know, things kind of come around again sometimes. So in the 70s and 80s, there were multiple synthetic materials that were evaluated as tracheal replacements. None of them ever made it into the clinic because they all failed. And they tend to fail for reasons of infection or erosion into surrounding tissues. You know, I think there have been some of these problems with the material that's being used now. It's a polyurethane sort of material. So I think that time will tell. But I do think if you're putting a large amount of synthetic material that's slowly degrading or non-degrading, you know, at the front line in a place that's constantly exposed to bacteria and fungi, it's a hard battle to win. You know, and that's different from using synthetics in sterile environments, like in the hip joint or, you know, in the vasculature. It's a different type of problem, but we'll just have to see.
I'm over here. Yeah. I have a question for the engineered arteries. What would be the effect in the aged population, and what would be your strategy to improve the arteries there?
Yeah. So in aged people, in the clinical trials that we've been doing, our patient recipients have ranged in age from about 30 to in their early 80s. I can speak to this a little bit. Out of 80 patients, we have small biopsies from about 6 or 7 patients who've undergone revisions or resections or something like that. And so we do have some evidence of how cells are repopulating. It doesn't look like there's a strong age effect so far in terms of rapidness of repopulation or in terms of propensity for narrowing or clotting or anything like that. So it's certainly an issue that we've thought about a lot. You know, you would anticipate that the very elderly would repopulate more slowly. You know, these people have shorter telomeres, you know, less cellular potential for replication. So far, with the limited numbers we haven't seen a strong signal there yet.
Okay, I think there's a question over on the left.
Hi. These are all beautiful talks. I have a question for Adam about the asynchrony that developed in your infarction in a dish model, your hypoxia model. Is that a property of the polymorphisms that's present in those cells, or is that a more general property?
Right, so I didn't mention some of the control experiments that we did, but you're hitting the nail on the head in that, for those that aren't familiar with it, 9P21 is a gene locus that's been associated with CAD, coronary artery disease. There's a thinking that it's a vascular phenotype in that epithelial cells sort of lose their, or endothelial cells lose their permeability. And so what we've seen in the patients that have one of these SNP polymorphisms, I guess that's redundant, but it's like an ATM machine. What we've seen though with the patients that have a SNP is that depending on which one it is, and we've only looked at one so far, we do see this asynchrony. In control experiments where you don't have these risk alleles, then you get pretty normal function. So we're really intrigued by the fact that this seems to be a SNP-dependent response.
Okay.
And it's in cardiomyocytes, which no one's really described. But you only then see it when you challenge them in this myocardial infarction in the dish.
So if I could ask another question. This is, I guess, both for Adam and Xiao Chen. I mean, the materials are phenomenal as you've been presenting it. Is it what do you think are the prospects for reducing the ability to modulate a matrix into something like I think of as a 384 well dish for screening? Is it possible to create systems that are inexpensive where you can apply a preload and alter the stress that's on cells in the culture and then measure the effects? What are the prospects for doing that in an inexpensive high throughput format?
So in our bioprinting system, we can add different things. I think if you want to actuate your scaffolds, you certainly can put magnetic beads and then actuate externally. Our system can be configured into 96 well plate platform. So certainly you just move the, for each window that we're printing is about 3 millimeter by 3 millimeter. So you can print one at a time and move to the next one. Ideally, if I have enough UV light power, I can print the whole screen like you just see the projection printing here. Because we use exactly the same projector in the lab, except we don't send a colorful light, we send a UV light to that gel.
I have the same answer. The materials that I showed, we can make in 96 well plates, and there are a couple of companies that do that. But I think that's sort of the limit of the technology right now.
And tuning it in an inexpensive real-world setting on a high throughput scale so that you can apply forces to cells, is that something that you can see happening in the foreseeable future?
I guess it depends on what's the high throughput angle. Because there are methods out there where you can apply forces over using like magnetic particles. And so you can apply thousands of forces to a single cell, and so you can get a very detailed map of individual cells. If you're talking about magnetically actuating an entire culture, there are some ways around that, but I think that would sort of be the limit of high throughput right now in terms of mechanical actuation.
Okay. There's one at the back.
Hi, my name is Ashley Fong from UC Irvine. I was noticing with a lot of the synthetic scaffolds, you guys are using UV light to polymerize. Is there any concern once you start mixing in the cells?
The UV light we use has a wavelength of 355 nanometers. It's not too deep in the UV range. So at this moment, we don't see that too much in terms of damage from UV itself. I think I showed the viability of those cells, and it's on the order of 85% to 95%, depending on what type of cells you're using.
We've also looked at phospho-P53 and other sort of damage markers, and we don't see, for the short 30 seconds to maybe 60 second exposures that we use, we don't really see any DNA damage. But longer, 5, 10, 15 minutes would certainly be an issue. And that's also then a limitation of trying to move these types of materials in vivo.
Yeah, I agree. So in our fabrication system, I show you that those conduits and all the vasculature-like structures, we really print it within 1 second. So it's a very minimal amount of UV in a very short time.
I have a question for Dr. Engler. So your dynamic substrate, after you stiffen it, can you reverse it back to a soft status? Or in other words, in a pre-pruned stem cell differentiation protocol, can you control the stiffness of the substrate for cells at different differentiation stages?
Yeah, that's a question that I get fairly often in terms of exactly how reversible this system is. And unfortunately, it really only moves one way or the other. And I say the other because Christy Ancest's lab at Colorado is, and she's a much better material chemist than I am. she can make materials that do the opposite, where it actually softens as a function of time. And we see, at least for development and disease processes, these stiffening hydrogels being much more advantageous. But you can go one direction or the other. It's tough to make it completely reversible then.
I have a question for Sharon. I was wondering, so you showed one slide where you have some microvasculature perhaps forming in some of these aggregates you printed. I was wondering, how far away do you envision fully vascularized tissues?
I think that's it's kind of a two-piece question. So the microvascular structures that we see do appear to form pretty extensive networks in the tissue, but because we're not introducing any type of flow in the examples that I gave here today, there's no impetus for those to really develop true connections with each other. So I don't lay any claim to those being patent perfusible networks that are there. They're just structures. I think on a small scale like that, just like Chris Hughes has done some really elegant work in this space, I think if you have the components there and you introduce the stimulus, you can actually get connection at the microvascular level and have some perfusion through a tissue. And I think that's achievable in a pretty short period of time. It's just a matter of doing the experiments. When you start thinking about scaling a tissue and making a liver lobe or a lung or something like that, that's an inherently much more difficult problem. And I think that's farther away. You know, you're asking not only to make the larger bore structures and have those be arborized in a meaningful way, but unless you're going to get down to the level of the capillaries and reconnecting them on the other side, whatever you make is gonna leak. And that's, you know, kind of as you saw in the lung. So I think that is it's a pretty tough order. I don't think it's impossible, but I just don't know that we've hit on the right combination of technologies to get there yet.
A question for Dr.
Actually, real quick, I just wanted to follow up, and then we'll go back to you. So following up on that question about vasculature, so obviously if you're going to 3D print something to go in vivo, you're going to need vasculature. So since we've heard a variety of different approaches of 3D printing, just wondering if the panel can comment on, you know, where do you see 3D printing going, you know, in the next, say, 5 years? In 5 to 10 years, do you think it's really going to be useful for these in vitro drug model screens, or do you really see it leaping into in vivo therapeutic type applications?
There's a lot of applications on the in vitro side that are not only revenue generating, which small companies care about, but they also teach us a lot about what the smallest functional unit of a tissue is that can be useful. I think there's also a lot of unmet clinical needs that can be served by very small pieces of tissue. And you don't necessarily have to have the image of having an entire liver in a package that can be tuned in with the transplant surgeon. You know, there are other ways to go about making things that are therapeutically relevant that I think can be implanted and expected to incorporate in a meaningful way with the host. You know, and I think the other thing we have to let go of a little bit is that what we implant that could have therapeutic relevance has to look exactly like what it was that the native tissue was when it came out. I think, you know, at the time of implant, we have to be open to having some workarounds that give us a temporary solution so the body can do its job and integrate. And if you're open to that, then I think it can happen faster.
Okay. Any other comments?
My personal opinion on the 3D printing space is that there's sort of cells and matrix. And if we look at connective tissues to include skin, bone, cartilage, blood vessel, on and on, you know, those are really matrix-heavy tissues that really rely on matrix for their function. And to date, although Shaoxian may prove us wrong very soon, but to date we don't have really good methods for printing matrix that's mechanically robust. We can print matrix molecules, but it's all sort of in a hydrogel format. So in terms of connective tissues, I actually think that we're currently a ways away from being able to use printing technology to print a connective tissue. But I would say that we're much closer with cell-heavy tissues, such as liver or pancreas or stuff like that.
I think there are hybrid approaches, too, where you may have an element of something that's purely cellular and compelling, mm-hmm. and then you may have the ability to fabricate something that's a hybrid structure that may contain some cells, but is primarily biomaterial, and being open to those kind of hybrid strategies might get us there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great.
Okay, thanks. So we'll go back to the that answer.
Oh, for Dr. Nicholson, I was curious, as in terms of getting a reconstituted alveolus, what do you think is sort of the I'm interested in kind of the cell density it's going to take to get kind of like a centimeter squared of, you know, usable real estate. And have you experimented with this, like the stoichiometry of, say, the type 2 alveolars to the microvascular endothelial cells and parasites and everything that comes in that preparation? And that maybe if you had a lot more endothelium than the alveolar cells, you could actually get kind of a lay down of a, or form a microvasculature and then have the epithelium form on top or around that.
Yeah, so in native lung, the stoichiometry of epithelium to endothelium in the alveoli is very roughly 1:1. There's probably more endothelial cells surrounding an alveolus, but it's, you know, rough order of magnitude 1:1. Type 1 and type 2 epithelial cells, there's a lot more type 1 cells than type 2 cells. The type 2 cells are really the local progenitor and they make surfactant. And then there's a few scattered sort of fibroblasts and lipofibroblasts that are invested around each alveolus, but those are comparatively sparse. You know, in terms of, you know, cell numbers per alveolus, I like to have numbers at hand, but that's not one that I have at hand, unfortunately. But I do think that in terms of, you know, what you need is effective surface area for gas exchange where the barrier is very thin, but yet is a very tight barrier. So you need dense endothelium on one side with really functioning tight junctions, and then dense epithelium on the other side, also with highly functioning tight junctions. What we know is that when we even gently strip those cells away, that 50 nanometer collagen type 4 barrier is widely permeable to anything that's, you know, a couple hundred nanometers. You know, so water, salt, solutes, everything just goes, proteins go straight across. So unless we reconstitute that with dense, similar numbers of cells on both sides, we're not going to have the right barrier function. I don't know if that, probably about half answers your question.
Yeah, well, I was just kind of curious if you thought maybe it would be like, say, like a 90:1 kind of cell ratio just to get those kind of densities sort of at an outcome. Because I could see where you would like to want to just overprint or just over-add, you know, as much as possible to try to get things to kind of start developing in the right way. I was also curious as to experiments you tried with just sort of laying things down as stem cells and just kind of seeing if they're laid in the right geometry that you can recapitulate organ function.
Well, certainly, ultimately, I think that reconstitution of the epithelium is really going to be the job of two or three local progenitor cells, like a basal cell and a Clara-like progenitor cell and maybe a type 2-like progenitor cell, and introducing smaller numbers of those cells and then allowing them to proliferate and giving them the right signals to reconstitute something that looks like an epithelium. I think in the airway, that's how this is going to work. The endothelium, I'm less sure about.
Okay. Sir. One question.
Yes. Great talk, guys. I have another question for Laura. It's great to see tissue engineered products this far into the market. Little question. Can you comment on the cost of manufacturing of the artificial?
I'm sorry?
Cost of manufacturing. The artificial artery, and as opposed, you know, compared to what's out there in the market, and if you have any strategies to convince the payers, assuming that it's a little higher than what's out there.
So it's not $20,000. It's not $20,000. I can tell you that we're right now in the 5 to 8K range per graft, as far as what it costs to make. I think that 1K per graft is entirely achievable with effort, and we're driving toward that number. But still, you know, you can buy a Teflon graft for $600 or $1,400, right? And you can't sell something for what it costs you to make. That's actually, it's hard to have a business that way. So really, what you know, and this is becoming more and more true, you know, month over month. You know, it's not going to be good enough to have something that's really cool, but doesn't, and much more expensive, but doesn't work much better, or doesn't make the patient better, or doesn't save long-term healthcare costs, right? And we, at Humacyte, we put a lot of effort into modeling, you know, how durable are these grafts? How many trips to the operating room do we save the patient if they last twice as long? And actually, you know, the total cost of replacing a graft, so when your Teflon graft fails at 1 year, the costs all in of putting in a new graft is $20,000. So if you can stretch that failure time out to 2 years, even if your graft costs $5,000, you've saved $20,000 at year one. So you have to be able to make those kinds of arguments. Otherwise, in the modern era, it's not going to work.